Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecrack's movie podcast.
Bangarang!
Rufio.
Yeah, that too.
Oh, what's up? I'm Austin Hayden Smit, and I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Ryan.
Sup, film fans?
We have fused, much like The Thing, form one podcast host. Hey, everybody. Bangarang and all that.
Bangarang and all that. That's right. So this week, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be talking about the 1991. I guess we can call it a classic, but we can talk about whether or not it's a classic. It's a classic, right? Hook, directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Robin Williams, Dustin Hoffman having a hell of a time, Julia Roberts, Bob Hoskins maybe even having more of a hell of a time, Maggie Smith. So before we get into the recap, let's do some first impressions. We also do just want to say, this was the film that was the patron chosen film. It was the one that won. So you all voted for this out
Thank
there.
You, patrons.
That's right.
My pick too.
And this was Ryan's selection. That's right. So he's gloating. So we're going to give him a victory lap right now
Thank
and
you.
Tell us his first impressions. And what do you think revisiting the film? How many times have you seen this? Why did you choose this film? Go ahead, Ryan.
When I first saw this, obviously as a kid, I only have good memories of it. To me, this was a classic film in my head, and I was definitely wondering, is it going to hold up, or is it going to be one of those things where it was more nostalgia and more just the time and place that I saw it? And no, the answer is it's a fucking classic movie that holds up. And I stand by it. It's probably one of the best kids movie I've ever seen. It just has the package, man. It has Steven Spielberg directing, Robin Williams' amazing performance, awesome side performances with Dustin Hoffman, Julia Roberts, Bob Hoskins, like you mentioned. I mean, everyone in it is awesome, and it just gives you the feels, which a kid movie should do, I feel like, or it's good when they do. But it also works for adults, and that's what the movie is fucking about, is kids and adults and growing up. And so I was pleasantly surprised that I'm not a kid anymore. I grew up just like Peter Pan did in the movie, and I still liked Hook. So I think that says something about the movie. I know Steven Spielberg was really disappointed in the film. It was a kind of a box office bomb, even though it made like over 100 million bucks. So it cost a lot of money. So that probably has something to do with it. But no, I think he should be very proud of the film. And I've watched actually like every Robin Williams documentary lately. So this is kind of a good syncing up that we did this podcast, because I was definitely in Robin Williams' mood. I mean, he is an enigma. I love it. He's an American treasurer. He's the best. So, and it was perfect casting for this. I mean, because he is the child in a giant adult body, also portrayed in Jack.
Hey, real quick, what are the documentaries that you've been watching on Robin Williams?
Well, there was Robin's Wish and Come Inside My Mind. Both are very good. They kind of tread over the same stuff, some of it, but they're both good to watch if you're a Robin Williams fan.
Cool. Okay, Raymond, what do you think about Hook?
I had seen this a couple of times as a kid. Hadn't watched it since. I don't really have the nostalgia bone. Even though I had seen this when I was younger, it still didn't really like trigger any real fondness. I had some memories surrounding it, but for the most part, I guess my thoughts on this are, I think it's a really cool idea for a family film. I like the premise that an adult Peter Pan has to return to Neverland to settle a score.
There better not be a butt in this sentence, Raymond. What is your butt?
But I'm not crazy about this movie.
What? Oh no.
I don't really it just doesn't really do anything for me, and I wish that I could say more, because I've seen a lot of folks online who hate on this movie, and I don't agree with that. I don't think there's anything in this movie that makes it like pure garbage or worthy of, you know, of my ire as a film fan, but it just doesn't really do anything for me. So I'm kind of excited to hear what you guys have to say about it and see if it can maybe spark something for me or hear your perspectives on this, because for me, it's just like, it's just a
no feels.
No, it just doesn't really do anything for me. I think there's a lot of there are a lot of interesting ideas. But it's just kind of boring for me. I think to say something nice about it, this was a pricey movie, and that money looks like it made its way on the screen. I mean, when they show up in Neverland, it feels like you're in a theme park. It's such a cool idea for a concept or a realization of that world is to make it like something recognizable the way that a theme park is, but still very fantastic. I think there's a lot of fun stuff going on. I think there is a lot to like about the film, but at the end of it, I'm just kind of left feeling like it's, I don't know, less than the sum of its parts.
That's very disappointing. I will say, to your point about it being boring or whatever, which I completely disagree with, it's not boring, but it is a 2 hour and I want to say 20 minute or 2 hour.
Yeah, it's 2 hour to 2.5 hours. Yeah.
2.5 hour family film is unexcusable, Steven Spielberg. What were you and your editor doing?
I think he's pushing it. I will say, I think the best parts of this movie are when it embraces the notion of it's being kind of like a live action cartoon. There are some of those
when the man becomes a cannonball.
Yeah, goofy stuff like that sticks in your mind. Those more indelible moments where I think it really works, or the kids, you know, skateboarding down and skateboarding up the half pipe to dunk a basketball. Goofy stuff like that is so well conceived as just like a single little gag, and I think that the movie just kind of collapses under its own weight. It's almost 2.5 hours. I think if it were a little more focused, if it were 90 minutes, if they got to Neverland a little bit quicker and got the story moving a little bit quicker, I probably would have had a much better time with it.
Yeah, so this film for me was definitely one of those ones that I watched a bunch when I was a kid, and I loved it. I loved the idea of, like, I wanted to live with the Lost Boys in Neverland. And plus, remember, this is 91, right? So all you wanted to do was, like, skateboard and ride your rollerblades. And so I was like, cool, man, they've got a freaking half pipe in their little home.
It's kind of a time capsule, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm like, that's all I want to do, you know, is kind of hang out with my boys and skate and stuff like that. So I wanted to be one of the Lost Boys, so I definitely have the nostalgic attachment to this. I also cannot, when someone mentions Hook, I actually kind of forget that Robin Williams is in it for a second, because I immediately think of Dustin Hoffman and Bob Hoskins just constantly. I also forget that Julia Roberts is in it. Not that they're not good in what they're doing, but I think that those two and that the pirate world and that the Lost Boys world are really what this film is about to me. I love it. It is the theme park come to life, and it still holds up for me in that respect. I think the story itself is fun too. You know, you've got this kind of like balance, if you will, or this challenge between the one side of pirates and adults, and then of course Peter Banning is like a real pirate in real life. He's a corporate pirate, right? Which is like what Wendy says. And then you've got youth and the beauty of youth and memory and things. So I think there's this really like wonderful juxtaposition of ideas, and it talks about memory and imagination, all things that I think are integral to storytelling. And so I think as a story, I think it does a really good job of trying to kind of like get to the value and the importance of youth and memory and holding on to the past and things like that. And so I think there's, which is an interesting spin, especially in the world today where it's like, forget the past and forget the future and just be present. No, there's something kind of wonderful about remembering where you came from and remembering the past. There's something there. So I think it's really interesting. I also do, before we kind of finish, get into the recap here, I got to give a shout out to Mr. Sexy Noodles, who challenged me on YouTube to go one episode without talking about capitalism and communism. And he said, and if I do that, he will buy me a beer. And I just want to say, Mr. Sexy Noodles, it's on. All right.
Well, you just, better not back out of the deal. You just blew it for this episode by talking about the deal.
Yeah.
Well, no. But okay, so here we go. We're going to go into the recap now. Okay. So basically, what would happen if Peter Pan did, in fact, grow up? Well, according to this story, he'd become a real-world pirate. Successful corporate lawyer Peter Banning is a workaholic and is pretty tuned out of his children's life. One night, while he and his family are visiting his wife's grandmother in London, Wendy Darling, his children are kidnapped by Captain James Cook. Wendy insists that Peter is actually truly Peter Pan and that only he can save his children by believing the truth. Later that night, Tinkerbell visits Peter and uses pixie dust to bring him to Neverland, and she drops him on the pirate side of the island, where he sees his children being held captive, causing him to reveal himself as Pan. Hook then challenges Peter to a duel, but when Peter fails to remember, Tinkerbell convinces Hook to give Peter 3 days to prepare for the final battle. Hook agrees, and Peter's sent to the home of the Lost Boys. This ragtag group of rambunctious youngins is led by Rufio, and the boys, they end up kind of mocking Peter at first with their allegiance to Rufio, but then eventually they come to see that he is in fact Peter, but just grown up. So they agree to train him and help him to fully remember. At the same time, however, Hook's right-hand man, Smee, convinces Hook to gain Peter's children's love so that they will choose him. And it sort of works for the son Jack, but daughter Maggie never wavers in her commitment to her father. Finally, Peter does remember what happened after repeated visits to Wendy in London. He basically fell in love with her granddaughter, Moira, and so he decided to give up eternal youth for love, another theme alert that we could probably explore. And this helps him remember his birth, which becomes the happy memory that enables him to fully regain his Peter Pan powers and fly. During the final duel with the pirates, you got the Lost Boys and you got the pirates fighting it out. Rufio's killed by Hook, which then triggers Peter to go full Pan badass, and he bests Hook, who's ultimately devoured by that massive stuffed croc who once took his hand. Peter then wakes up in London, reunited with his family, and with a firm commitment to spend more quality time with them. But just before the film closes, Wendy tells Peter that his adventures are not yet over. End of film. Before we continue, I want to give a shout out to Storyblocks. Storyblocks is the complete stock solution to providing an unlimited library of over 1 million plus royalty-free high-quality video, audio, and images. If you're a creative, then you know how pricey stock media can get. It ranges so widely, and single music track could cost you thousands of dollars. With Storyblocks, you can stay on budget with the most affordable subscription plans that still give you the tools you need to finish your project. Here at Wisecrack, we find different music for every video, so it's great that we can just hop on and download as many tracks as we need without having to worry about the individual price. We can test out each asset to see what we like, and there's no worry we'll accidentally spend on something we don't need or doesn't fit. The best part is that we'll stay on budget and we won't get those nasty copyright strikes. If you have a project and you need high-quality stock solution, then check out Storyblocks today. Click the link in the show notes or go to storyblocks.com/wisecrack to learn more about their subscription plans. Now back to the show. All right, so let's jump straight into something that Ryan made a point of at the outset, where he said this was like a box office failure. Was it a box office failure or was it a box office success? Because I feel like this is a real beloved film, and I know it made over 300 at the box office, but I know this is a real beloved film by many. Although I will say it was definitely a critical failure. So was it a box office?
Well, Box Office Mojo says it only made $120 million on a $70 million budget, which would be a failure. Because, you know, you usually cut that in half. So they're getting about $60 million of that, which isn't the whole budget. Although Wikipedia says that it was a slight box office success somehow. $300 million. So, yeah. But like only a slight. So I don't know what to believe. But either way, it wasn't a giant blockbuster like they obviously wanted it to be with all those giant set pieces and whatnot. So it did not live up to the box office whatever standards and then
hopes or expectations.
But then also critics didn't like it. Like Roger Ebert gave it a really bad review and said it was just a Peter Pan rehash, and critics, you know, don't like it. But kids have decided that they liked it, and they're the only ones that
matter. So here's the thing, like who you know, we put so much credit in like Rotten Tomatoes scores and in these professional reviewers, and sometimes I think there's value in that, especially if you find somebody that is a reviewer that you really value their film sensibility. But at what point do you just say like, dude, shut the fuck up and stop using this metric? This is a good film and it's fun. Like, let's stop being critics and let's just let films be. Yeah,
I never take the Rotten Tomatoes seriously. I mean, it's just another little tool there, a little like they're like, oh, okay, that's what the audience thinks, that's what the critics think. Yeah, you know, what do I think? Yeah. You know, so it's always just a little anecdotal information to me. It's not like the end all be all of, am I gonna see this movie based on usually.
I think there's also a tendency with a lot of critics to grade on a curve a little bit. And because Steven Spielberg was a critic's darling for so long, I think they, I mean, there are some movies that he has made late in his career. I think Bridge of Spies particularly is a wonderful film that if anyone else was making, people wouldn't shut up about, oh, this new kid on the block who just came out with this such a mature film. It's really great. And, you know, so assured behind the camera. But I think we do take Steven Spielberg for granted a lot because he's made consistently, you know, good to great work for what, like 50 years now.
And I think I like all the late stuff too. I think it's all good.
I think he's had a lot of really, really solid films throughout his career. But I think that Hook may have been a victim a little bit of that expectation versus reality. And that's the guy in the chat who's not a huge fan of this movie. I don't think it's worth savaging still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there I did read a quote of his where he says that basically he never really had a firm grip on the script. He really liked the first act, but he didn't really know how to kind of execute the rest of it. And he said, and he covered over a lot of those insecurities and those uncertainties with production design. And so that's why you kind of just get this over-the-top, bombastic, artistic direction. But here's the thing for me. I actually find the production design and the artistic design to be my favorite part of the film. It is a theme park come to life. And I feel like I'm on Tom Sawyer's Island at Disneyland when I'm watching this film. And it helps me, like, it puts me in the place of me running around in tree houses when I was a kid, or running around in the dirt and in the canyons and bike riding through like streams and things. Like, that's what it does for me. So I actually think that's the strength of this film.
I think absolutely. That's one of those. Oh, go ahead, Ryan.
I was just going to echo what you were saying, and I'm glad you brought up tree houses because I remember distinctly being a kid and being enthralled with tree houses. I wanted my own tree house so bad that I could hang out and make my own house with my friends. And then this is like the ultimate version of that. This is like if you had all the resources, like, wow, they made this and they're just kids living there. And that's like the ultimate kid fantasy is no adults on a whole island. And I'm making this amazing, castle with my friends, like with half pipes and basketball courts and stuff. Fuck yeah.
Hell yeah.
Like, this is the life.
It's Lord of the Flies, but awesome.
Yes.
I think there may be something telling in that, though, that Spielberg feels most connected to that first act. You know, one of the things that I like about a lot of Spielberg's work, especially his early stuff, I think of E.T. particularly as, like, his greatest family film, at least in my estimation. And one of the things I like about E.T. so much is that he takes those kids and their emotions seriously. He doesn't look down on them. He never lets his camera look down on them. It is like a movie that is as much about the inner child being expressed by a filmmaker as this movie should be, in a way, if that makes sense. And I kind of think there's a distance between Spielberg and that inner child with this film that, like you said, he ends up maybe connecting most with that first act because that's how he sees himself now, is more as the Peter Banning character. He has all of these responsibilities and stuff. And it's not necessarily to his discredit. You know, people change, their perspectives change. But I think that may be telling that he felt like he kind of had to fake his way through the more childish aspects of it. Maybe he just didn't feel as connected to that inner child anymore. And maybe that's something that not necessarily saying that I'm watching this going, oh, man, I just don't feel that classic Spielberg inner child right now. But one of those things that's so great about Spielberg's work, regardless of who his subject is or what age they are, is he's wonderful at capturing a sense of awe and a sense of wonder. It's that memeified Spielberg face where it's the camera kind of, you know, zooming in on a face that's looking up at a horizon and just, like I said, sheer awe and wonder. And I don't think there's anything in this movie that really inspires that same feeling, at least
not
for me.
Yeah.
Well,
see,
that's why we're here to talk about it. Go
I know.
Ahead,
I know. That's what I'm saying is that all this, it really surprises me that Spielberg doesn't like this movie. Maybe like, I think that maybe he let the reception, absorb too much into it or something, or maybe he's honest and really doesn't like it. Cause to me, I feel the total opposite of the middle of the film where they're hanging out with the kids. For one, all the kid actors are amazing. And you really feel like they're all solid characters and not one-dimensional. But, like, I had the moment with the food fight at the beginning when they're all eating the fake food, and then all of a sudden Robin Williams, you know, does the when the food initially appears and flies in the guy's face, and they're all sitting there and they're having just the kind of push-ins that you're talking about on their faces, like, wow, and the John Williams music's playing, like he made believe the food happened. I feel that, like, I'm like there in that, especially as a kid, and yeah. Even today I'm like, that moment was cool, and then I feel like that's sprinkled throughout. So
I'm not saying that he doesn't go for those notes. I'm not saying that he doesn't try to play those notes. I'm saying it just doesn't work.
Didn't land
quite
for you
right for me,
yeah. As a jaded 30 something
grumpy
old
man,
black hearted.
I think I'm being very generous.
I'm just fucking with you.
One example right to that end is for example, when Robin Williams comes back and he's learned to fly again, and he cuts his way through the sail in order to like, you know, float through that, he cuts the silhouette out of it. And when they pick up the cutout part of the silhouette, it's like, it's perfectly defined. It looks exactly like there's even hairs that are cut into it. It's so perfectly detailed. And I know that this is a fun, goofy, cartoonish movie, but it's one of those things that, like, for all of that buildup, and then for Robin Williams to just kind of float forward, it just feels like there's something missing, you know. It feels like he's going for that big moment, the bicycles in front of the moon, you know. It feels like he's going for something big and iconic, which is something he's so great at doing throughout his career, and it just doesn't. It just never feels like it lands for me. It feels like I'm watching an imitation.
Okay,
interesting.
Different strokes for different folks.
I feel like, yeah, and I feel like there's two ways to look at this. Maybe, I mean, maybe more, but at least two ways. One is that Steven Spielberg is a grumpy old man, and he's longing for the days of youth, and he's looking at children around him, and he's like, man, it sucks that you're a corporate lawyer. It sucks that you're a filmmaker that's trapped in the business world. That kind of sucks. Why can't I just go back to, like, remembering youth, which was filled with potential and hope and beauty and connection and love and passion and all these things, right? So it's like he's looking back at that. And then from that perspective, it kind of then is like, ah, so what he views youth as is just this purely, like, abstract conception of youth. And so he's totally detached from it. And that's why it doesn't work. The other way to look at it, and this is the way that I actually tend to favor, is that actually there's something that is powerful about that backward look that is basically saying, you know what, I still have that inner child within me. And that inner child within me is actually what is the creative impulse of me being a storyteller. Right? And it's actually what draws me to certain types of tales. And the tale of Peter Pan about this boy that never grows up is amazing. And then what would happen if that were corrupted somehow by sending that person into a world that's filled with all these familial pressures and livelihood pressures? And of course, you know, you find love, which is a sort of like passion that detracts you from youth. So it's like you can only choose one or the other. I think that that's a really interesting and rich kind of way to tell a story. And for me, that's kind of the way that I view this film.
Yeah, I get that. It ends up kind of being like a Christmas Carol at the end, that he wakes up, yeah, on the street, and he's reinvigorated, and he's found that, yeah, inner child again. And I understand that. I'm not.
And he is in London, and it is Christmas time.
I'm not objecting. I'm not objecting to the intent in any way. It's just all I'm trying to say is that it doesn't hit me. And I don't think it's my cynicism either, because every time I watch E.T., when Elliot is being shuffled out of the room by the faceless, you know, feds, and E.T.'s heart light starts to glow again, but no one sees it, I get a little misty-eyed. I get goosebumps just thinking about it. Like, and that's the thing, is that he's so good at constructing those moments throughout the course of his filmography. And in this one, it kind of feels like someone going through the motions a little bit. And it sounds like, by Spielberg's own admission, there were some times where he maybe felt the same way.
Dude, I didn't realize it. This is literally Peter Pan meets A Christmas Carol. This is like, what would happen if Peter Pan were Scrooge? Yeah, and what he does is he goes back to the past. He doesn't really have, you know, the ghost of the present and the ghost of the future, but he does have the ghost of the past, right? Tinkerbell is that ghost of the past that brings him to the past. And he's able to kind of, like, go back there and remember.
His Jacob Marley, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And his happy memory is like birth and life and being human. Like, that's the happy memory that is also, I think, really lovely, right? It's not like, oh, the time that I won the game or something like that. It's a very sort of just like simple, like, I was born and I had a mother and I am like earthly. So there's also something kind of amazing about that that I think is really kind of celebratory and wonderful. And yeah, it is a Christmas Carol story.
That is interesting. I've never made that connection. But one thing I will say, watch the difference between these viewings is I distinctly remember as a kid, I had no, there's a complete logical disconnect about how the fuck can a man, a grown person, not remember their childhood, you know, like literally physically, like have zero memory, like it was amnesia and didn't happen. You know, did any of you guys watch it that way when you were kids? Like,
I think, that occurred to me maybe as a kid, but in the context of the story and also knowing more about how our brains are wired to, like, for with trauma, for example, you know, that we can repress things that, and not sure. To say that his time on Neverland was traumatizing, but, you know, the brain is such a weird and complicated thing. It makes a little bit more sense in the context of the story now. But.
Well, yeah, but like you would never forget that you could fly and had a fight with a pirate and a crocodile and all this shit like that actually physically happened to you as a child. Like, I don't think you would literally forget about that. And I definitely remember thinking this time, like, oh, that it really is more of a metaphor, just kind of like you don't remember the feeling. You kind of remember, distant memories in the fog and haze of your adult memories. But the feeling of you being a kid and stuff, that's really what they're saying, is that you can forget that. And then you become jaded and then time has passed and then you have no real compassion for what it's like to be a kid. And I love that part about it now, but I definitely, obviously, as a kid, you have no concept of that, and you're like, what? And then I'm like, wait, he really literally forgets everything he ever did as a kid? That's fucking weird. Okay.
That brings up the one thing that I would say, if I had to go in there and cut 30 minutes out of this, a lot of the stuff that I would chop out is the references to, like, his family is, it's weird to me, and this is probably just a me thing, so tell me I'm an idiot, but it is weird to me that this universe has the family from the story Peter Pan, and then they also have the book Peter Pan that is still apparently very culturally influential and just as famous as it is in our universe. And everyone is like, yeah, my grandma's the lady from the Peter Pan book, but they never seem to have really drilled down on that in the past 40 years, because otherwise they probably would have recovered Robin Williams' memories sooner. Like, it's weird to me that this book is so popular to the point that, like, they're doing the play at school. When she sees her grandma, she's like, oh, yeah, I played the role that's based on your life. But none of them actually scrutinize the implications of that in any way, shape, or form.
Well, maybe the answer is just don't think about it.
See, this is what I kind of... Yeah. I always thought that they never took her seriously, right? Like, this was just a tale that she told. Like, it wasn't a true story. It was a sort of, like... fictional biographical account, and she was a wonderful storyteller, and that she exaggerated and used hyperbole and stuff like that. And so then I wonder, is there a way that we could even read all the Neverland stuff as being just a dream?
Well,
or do you think it leans into the realism pretty heavily?
During this watch, I kept thinking they should cut to Robin Williams at the end, having fallen out of the big open window that he kept telling Jack to keep closed, and, like, this whole movie is just the final DMT hit while his brain leaks out of his ears. And watching it from...
Jesus,
like,
that's the dark version.
Well, no, I know, but that's... I mean, that is essentially, like... the Christmas Carol aspect of it, when you come away from it's like, well, did it really happen, or was this just a dream that he needed to, you know, reignite that fire within? Or the Wizard of Oz thing, where you were there and you were there and you were there and I'll never leave Kansas again. Like, there is that aspect or that energy to it. Obviously, I don't think that's what Steven Spielberg was going for, but he does. I mean, a few people in the chat have pointed out he wakes up in the street surrounded by like empty alcohol bottles, and there's a guy.
Well, and Smee.
Bob Hoskins is sweeping, and he goes, hey, you might want to, like, get inside before you die, or, like, whatever he says. And it does have that Wizard of Oz vibe that, like, this could have 100% just been he went off on a bender because he fucking hates his wife and kids so much.
He found my marbles.
I did find the marbles. Lovely. What is it? Tittles? Tuttles? Tootles? Tittles?
Tittles? Tootles.
Okay, so before we keep going, I got to give a shout out to our another sponsor, which is Skillshare. Skillshare is pretty freaking awesome, guys. Basically, it is a community where you can unleash your creativity and pursue your passions right from the convenience of your home. It's an online learning community. They have classes where you can basically connect with other like-minded people and creatives, where you can explore projects that you're passionate about. And they offer a huge range of classes: iPhone photography, drone filming, editing, classes on improving productivity, video for Instagram, which I need because I am terrible at video on Instagram. They have a new one called Artivism that is about like using art for social purposes and for change. And so if you want to explore your creativity and connect with some cool people along the way, make sure you go to SMTM. Let's do that again, just so we're clear on this. It's Skillshare.com/SMTM, as in show me the meaning. So that's Skillshare.com/SMTM, and you'll get a free trial of their premium membership. So go to Skillshare.com/SMTM or click the link in the show notes below. All right, let's keep talking about Hook here. So we've talked a little bit about like children, we've talked about nostalgia, we've talked about youth, all these other things. Let's talk about the performances. Yeah. What do y'all think about Dustin Hoffman, about Bob Hoskins? I mean, they're just going full ham here.
I think
right?
those
like,
two are having
like
a hell of a time.
Yeah.
They're having a great time. What's that, Ryan?
About all the performances or just those two?
Let's start with those two.
I think those two are front of the pack. I think that they Bob Hoskins especially is just bouncing off the walls. Dustin Hoffman doing like a literal mustache twirling bit as the villain in this. And
yes.
He is not the person that you would think when you're casting Captain Hook, who I want a real devious sort in there. I mean, Dustin Hoffman, by all accounts, is kind of a crummy person. But at this time, and his persona as an on-screen star does not immediately scream Captain Hook. But I think he does a great job.
Robin Williams, he plays it, especially after watching these docs like I've been telling you about. You would kind of expect him to play it, even when he gets to Peter Pan, like a little bit more sillier at some point, but
he doesn't do the Robin Williams thing.
Yeah,
he's
doesn't
never,
do
like,
his normal shtick. It's like he has to be the opposite, which is kind of counterintuitive for a Peter Pan movie. But he's playing a grown up, you know.
It is kind of weird to see him on, like so firmly on the leash in such a fantastic environment, because you'd think that there would be at least a few scenes where Steven Spielberg just sort of let him loose to do his, you know, his ad-libbing, his voices, his, you know, his whole shit.
Yeah, if you told me you were going to make a two-hander and it was going to star Dustin Hoffman and Robin Williams, and one of them was going to be the straight man and one of them was going to be the non-straight man, tell me who do you think would play what role, right? But that's absolutely not the way it is here, right? There's just so much kind of chaotic energy that Dustin Hoffman is using, and it kind of, I think it forces, like, I'm sure it was an intentional choice, but it forces Robin Williams to be on that leash. So that's probably just good direction on the part of Spielberg, and maybe character choice from Williams as well.
I would have loved to have been there for all the kids they had to whittle down, because he's just so good at casting fucking kids, man. Like, it's such a good ensemble of those Lost Boys, and I think that they fucking, from what I read or somewhere online, like, I think it was it's always a hassle to direct kids, you know, but like a bunch of them that are apparently it was pretty rowdy on set and he had a hard time wrangling them and it took fucking forever. And they went like 40 days over budget or over schedule or whatever.
Not just having to direct, you know, 20 or 30 kids who are all having the time of their life on a film set, but having the time of their life on this film set that is designed to be a playground, that is designed to be a theme park, a fantasy. They have a literal baseball diamond like on their back lot for this. Like, it's, I mean, this is, I remember reading about Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and when the kids first go into the inventing room in that movie is literally the first time that any of that cast had seen that set, and and literally I think close to half of that set was actually edible. There was a lot of stuff in there that those kids could just immediately like grab a handful of and shovel into their face, and they said that it was just like. It was like walking into a dreamland, and I imagine that that would be kind of similar to this. But when we're talking about casting, I don't know if you guys know this, but Michael Jackson coveted this role. He was Peter Panning or whatever his name is at the beginning. He was good friends with Spielberg at the time, and he lobbied hard for this role, and was so upset with Spielberg for not casting him that he is reported to have hired a witch doctor to cast a spell on Steven Spielberg to kill him like years after this came out.
That cannot be a real thing.
There is reporting on this. I don't know if it actually happened, but he is alleged to have spent like $150,000 to get a witch doctor to cast a spell on 25 different people, Spielberg included, because he was not cast in Hook.
What a dick.
His dream role of Peter Pan. But I guess the thing that Spielberg told him to like throw him off the project scent was he basically said, "Oh, this isn't a Peter Pan that you would want to play. He's like a boring old lawyer. That's not going to be interesting to you."
Okay.
But I mean, just think about how fucking insane that would be. I mean,
very insane.
It's just not my I doubt that Ryan would have the same feelings about this film as he does, and I would be a lot less generous in my criticism of it if he were.
Would give it a very different vibe. Honestly, when I think about why all the reasons I like this movie, it really isn't Robin Williams's performance, even though I it's kind of the stuff that you said. It's the production value. It's the Lost Boys. It's Rufio. It's, you know, all that shit. And he does kind of give a muted performance. It's you know, he's from Juilliard, right? So he's a very serious professionally trained actor.
He's a fine actor.
Yeah. And it's funny because you can kind of go down his filmography and really put him in categories on what, you know, is he going insane, Mork and Mindy style? Like that's like Aladdin and Jack and all that shit. Mrs. Doubtfire. But then there's his Good Will Hunting and his serious shit. His one hour photo and whatever. Insomnia.
Have you seen World's Greatest Dad?
I love that movie. That's definitely in the second category. And I'd kind of put his performance in this, oddly enough, a kid's movie, in the second category of like playing a serious role. Mm. And then it just, but it just so happens, you know, that he kind of, that's part of the theme of the film is that it's him growing out of that, but he never really goes full Mork and Mindy, like we were saying before.
If you had to swap out one of the main characters in this, either Hook or Peter, is there anyone you think of from that era who really could have knocked it out of the park for you, Ryan? Who could have taken this movie from great to perfect?
I think everyone's perfectly cast. No,
everyone's pretty good.
I don't think there's anyone I would. I guess I only from sheer curiosity I want to see that Michael Jackson cut.
You brought up Rufio, and I'm curious how you feel about. I feel like Rufio was done dirty in this picture.
What?
He's the classic.
Hold on. I agree. He's a great time, but he gets iced by Captain Hook, and then 20 seconds later, all the Lost Boys are like, "All right, well, you know, Captain Hook got eaten by the alligator. Ooh, thank you for the sword, Peter. I'll be sure not to stab myself when I'm rolling around with it." And
they are
Rufio
warriors. Okay, they are warriors, and they remember their pal who died in battle, but they've moved on. They're hardened Lost Boys.
That's right. Yeah, and there's also something that we just don't know. Maybe they had a huge year of memorial for Rufio afterwards, right? We don't know. We can't assume. You can't judge somebody's grieving process, Raymond.
I'm talking, yeah. I am talking about the audience's grieving process, which is non-existent. We don't get a single moment to process Rufio's death after he flies up. He goes no, and then they fight, and then
looky, I got
Hook
hooky.
Gets gobbled up, and that's it. And they don't mention Rufio again. They don't breathe his name.
You know, it's interesting. It is funny that Rufio. I mean, one of my favorite pop punk bands when I was like a young teen was Rufio. Did you guys ever listen to Rufio? Do you know the band?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. I've seen him
Yeah, exactly, dude. Like that kind of vibe. Like that was my world when I was like 14 to 19, you know? So, but yeah, it is interesting that Rufio, like when I think of Hook, I think of Dustin Hoffman, I think of Bob Hoskins, and I think of Rufio. And so I feel like it's interesting that a supporting character has become, maybe it's the hairstyle, maybe it's just because it's kind of like that chant, the Rufio, Rufio, Rufio. I mean, there's something magnetic about him as an actor, and apparently he has resurfaced and has become like a TikTok celeb.
Oh, really?
I just had a friend on Twitter tell me this, so that's friggin' awesome. Good for him. But there is something magnetic about this character and about him as
an actor. Next week, we'll be reviewing Rufio's TikTok.
Exactly. But why is that, do you think? Like, why are people, like, attracted? Why do they gravitate to this character so much?
He's just he's a bad boy. He's James Dean. He's James Dean cool rolling in on his little wind skateboard. And then
I mean,
he has a foul mouth calling Peter a beetle eater. Or whatever the fuck all their stupid insults are. Like he's the fella that you know you can never bring home to mom, but boy oh boy, if you know that you can always bum a cigarette off of him. He's just a cool cat.
And how come he's like 27 and the rest of the Lost Boys are like 12?
Was he that old? I'm curious how old he actually
was.
He's like
15 or
14. That's why they look up to him, is that he is the man among boys, you know, or just the
elder statesman.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, dude, he is that one dude that is at every school that's just like the man, you know? You're like, oh yeah, you know, the most. And it's the dynamic of all the kids to him. Like you said, they look up to him. So that's kind of why it rubs off on you as a kid. You're like, oh, Rufio. I want to be like Rufio. You know, I want to be that dude. It kind of reminds me of what's that dude's character? The second main character in The Sandlot. The leader of the gang, right? I forget his
name. Benny the Jet Rodriguez?
Yeah, exactly.
Benny.
The Jet. You know, it's just like he's the fucking man and he's the leader. And you follow, he's level-headed and he leads you in battle and he's confident and stuff and he's just the fucking man, you know, like so that's why he's the classic character, and then he has a cool chant to go along with it. So
yeah. women want him and Lost Boys want to be him.
Right.
I'm a Lost Boy. Okay, so before we jump into the mailbag here, let's just briefly talk about Spielberg, right? We talked about him a little bit, but like, what do we think? Obviously, he doesn't really have too many misses. Maybe this is one of the, quote, misses, at least in some people's eyes, although I think that it's still a really enjoyable film personally. Huge Ryan show. Does, Raymond not so much. Yeah. What are your favorite? Like, what's top tier Spielberg for you? Like, top three. What's top tier?
Oh, man, you got to just spring
Ryan,
that on me
Ryan,
right now.
You got him.
I'm surfing over to IMDb you gotta Google as we speak. But
off the top of my head.
Is it 80s? Is it like 70s, 80s?
I love
Spielberg?
I think Jaws is one of the greatest movies ever made.
Yeah.
Jaws to me is a perfect film. That would be my favorite Spielberg film. But I think E.T., the first Indiana Jones, is so much fun. I mean, he's, you know, no one else could do what peak Steven Spielberg could do, which is just like take all of these crazy influences and turn out these fantastic worlds that still have a real sense of gravity and have a real sense of stakes about them. Yeah, go ahead, Ryan.
I gotta do four. I can't do three. I gotta do four.
Okay,
all right,
give me your four.
And my four are Close Encounters of the Third Kind. To me, that's one of the best films of all time. Hook, one of this movie, and then Jurassic Park and Saving Private Ryan. Those four are my top four.
Okay.
I would also throw in, I loved Bridge of Spies. Catch Me If You Can kind of flies under the radar, but is an extremely...
Are these in your top four?
They're up
He's
there.
Made some good movies.
I think those ones are really fun, and I also think Minority Report and War of the Worlds is kind of once again another under the radar, like stealth, very good Spielberg movie. He did that and Minority Report with Tom Cruise. They both have a cool look to them, and I think they're a lot of fun.
Under the radar, those two are for sure, but I wouldn't say top four.
Yeah, I like Minority Report a lot, but for me, it's the 70s and 80s and early 90s Spielberg that is really the best. My favorite Spielberg film is probably...
That 30-year decade span, yeah.
Yeah, 30-year, yeah. Well, since War of the Worlds and after, or maybe, like, was that around Minority Report? Like, that, like, you know, late 90s into early 2000s, I kind of haven't been in love with his stuff. There's something about the wonder of Jurassic Park, the Indiana Jones films, E.T., like those films to me, they have something that the more recent films don't have. And I don't know what it is. There's a magic. And I don't want to just be that grumpy dude that is like, I hate digital. But I do wonder if the shift to special effects, computer generated stuff has kind of detracted a little bit from the worlds that he built, right? Like, obviously Jurassic Park uses some amazing technology, but it also uses animatronics in a way that is absolutely fantastic. And I feel like for me, that's kind of like the synthesis, like it's the hinge at which he kind of goes in a direction that I don't love, but it's the culmination of kind of everything up to that point
yeah.
for me.
Jurassic so that's Park, kinda the, those the effects apex. Still hold up in a way that so many Dude. Movies that came after them just don't. And I will say, I think the same year Jurassic Park came out was also when Schindler's List came out, and that to me is like kind of the apex as a filmmaker, that you can release an Oscar-winning movie and a movie that is one of the biggest blockbuster four quadrant pleasers in the same year. I don't think Steven Spielberg, I mean, this is going to sound crazy because he's probably the most applauded filmmaker who has ever lived. I think we underrate Steven Spielberg as a filmmaker. I mean, the guy was absurdly prolific. His hits to misses ratio was insanely high, insanely in his favor, I would say. I mean, the guy knows how to make a picture. You got to give him credit.
What boggles my mind is talking about effects and special effects and are they better or worse now? It's the Jurassic. When I look at Jurassic Park effects, which is like 93, and it's literally the best fucking special effects ever in a movie. It's the pinnacle, the peak, right? I'm not saying best ever. Like there's not anything better than that. But in terms of like, do I believe those are dinosaurs? Yes. Right. And yeah. if you made a dinosaur movie today, or even the last Jurassic World, obviously there's so many shots where I'm like, all right, well, that's clearly not a real dinosaur. That's a fucking computer dinosaur. There's just no way that it's a real dinosaur, or it's even an animatronic or whatever. I do feel like just on an industry-wide thing, we've gone backwards from Jurassic Park, because that's always my gold standard. If I ever see a computer-generated shot that kind of is out of the way or out of place, I'm like, why? We did it so well in 93 with Jurassic Park. Why have we gone back? Why have we regressed?
Well, I think that has to do with the fact that back then CGI was only advanced enough to hide the seams of practical effects. And I think to this day,
that's
CGI is still best deployed when it's just used to hide the seams, to hide the wires, so to speak.
David Fincher does this really well in an expansive sense by building out city drops in the background, but it's very subtle. It's just kind of, you wouldn't even know that in certain films, David Fincher is actually using boatloads of CGI, but he does it in a way that is kind of really lovely because, like you just said, it hides the cracks of the landscape.
To build out environments and to help sell it. I mean, I would put Jurassic Park, as far as visual effects are concerned, I would put it up there with last week's work from The Thing, Rob Bottin's masterful work in that. And to tie these two films together, they're both shot by Dean Cundey. Phenomenal Whoa. Cinematographer.
Oh, look at that.
So props to Dean Cundey.
Amazing.
I want to make another comment too on...
Yeah, last word, Ryan, and then we'll jump into the mailbag.
Yeah, the whole thing about is it film that is is it digital versus film that's making it to where Spielberg doesn't make as good Spielberg movies? And I would argue that it's the times we're living in, just like zeitgeist-wise. Like, I don't think that... It's hard to make a Spielberg-y film today... and not feel like it's trying to be nostalgia porn or something, because people are so fucking cynical and jaded at, you know, talking about Hook and stuff. Like, people just today in general, everybody is more jaded than Steven Spielberg.
J.J. Abrams might be the guy that's trying to make Spielberg, like, Super 8 is a Spielberg film.
Yeah,
right?
But like, just like,
yeah,
it only is in the sense that there's kids in it and there's lens flares and he does the same push-ins and stuff that Raven was talking about earlier. He's just aping the style way less. Yeah. He never, I feel like, nails the true feeling of those movies, you know, with that John Williams score and just and stuff. And so basically my point is that I think that if you shot E.T. today, literally beat for beat the same script, it would not feel the same because kids and people aren't the same as they were. And I think Spielberg, his mind, he's the best director that was emblematic of the zeitgeist of the 70s and 80s and stuff, that kind of, like, I don't know, people were just not the not jaded people that lived back then.
There is something to say about, like, a post-ironic world, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, there's a lot that we've talked about on Wisecrack. Like, the Bo Burnham video talked about this. So if you're interested, you can check that one out. There's a lot of stuff that it kind of shapes the way that we can do art in a world that is cynical and, as Ryan just said, maybe a tad jaded.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, no. All I was going to say is that every movie has its moment. And I think, you know, it's a fun hypothetical to entertain. We'll never know. But I think there are a lot of wonderful films from back then that would just disappear in today's landscape, you know. Times change.
All right, so now let's jump into the mailbag. So for those of you out there that are listening, those of you in the chat, those of you that are listening on the podcast as this has been released afterwards, remember that you can call us in and you can give us suggestions, you can give us your hot takes on the film, you can agree or disagree with us. Please do. We love to hear from you. The number to call in is 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. You can leave us a little voicemail. So first we're going to start off with Michael, who has some thoughts on The Thing. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, Wisecrack guys and folks and people. This is Michael from Rhode Island calling. Love the show. I think Austin, you're doing a great job moderating. Wanted to bring up something with The Thing. I know that the idea that perhaps The Thing could be a metaphor for AIDS was brought up, but I believe I read some criticism back in college when I was taking a sci-fi film studies course about the film, is that one of the parallels was drawn with cancer, that the thing attacked you at the cellular level, much like cancer does. Cancer replaces healthy cells and does terrible things to the body. That's kind of what the thing does. It infects and replaces human cells with alien cells, causing all sorts of problems. So wanted to see what you all thought about that possible interpretation. Keep up the good work. Thank you for all the great content, and stay safe.
Thanks so much, Michael. Yeah, this is interesting. You know what it just triggered in my mind is the film Annihilation, that
great
similarly
movie.
Has
yeah.
that
great
has
a
same film. Yeah, it's about life being exponentially increasing rather than an infection destroying life, which is a very good point, Michael. Yeah, what do you guys think?
I kind of like what I said on the podcast. There's lots of way, you know, this movie is ripe for you to kind of say what a one-to-one The Thing is supposed to mean. It would be weird to me if John Carpenter came out and said, oh yeah, The Thing is about cancer. Like, I don't know. Like, I get what he's saying though. It does attack you like a cancer, but I don't know if it's a metaphor for cancer.
Even the simulation kind of feels that the way that it absorbs cells and starts to replicate on its own.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, it is, I guess, yeah, literally it is a cancer in so far as how it acts. But I think moreover, the cool thing that we kind of touched on about The Thing last week was that it can, like we mentioned, The Thing is not any one thing. It literally could just be this virus, and that is the extent to which life exists on whatever planet The Thing came from. And I really, really like that. I like that it is this unseeable, unknowable threat that may not even know that it's affecting you is, you know, like when they do the blood test and there's just a natural reaction for it to defend itself and jump out of the little petri dish is like, I don't think the thing is even aware of those guys in there. It's just looking for new cells to assimilate.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. So now we're going to jump into an email for the last thing that we're going to talk about in the mailbag. You can, if you don't want to call us or if you can't call us for whatever reason, you can also email us at movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. This is an email from Marlin. It's on The Thing, and Director Deep Dive Suggestion was the title. So it's, hey, Wisecrack, I listened to your recent SMTM on The Thing and loved the takes. I had only seen it for the first time a few weeks ago when the country froze over and really loved how it made my skin crawl. I loved the point about the film being almost meta-symbolic, I don't know if that's a word, about paranoia and otherness being a part of the human condition. In school, I thought a lot of the time the analysis could focus too much on specific allegory or symbolism, and I really enjoyed all the viewpoints that could be projected onto the titular thing in a way that made the movie feel so much larger than a standard X equals Y narrative, kind of like what Ryan was just saying, maybe. So thank you so much for that. I'm going to go watch the movie 12 more times. We definitely recommend that, by the way, Marlon. Also, he says, you ask for a director deep dive, and he said he has an odd suggestion. Roland Emmerich is his suggestion.
Okay,
and
I love him.
And he says, here's why. His movies often display similar motifs that are highly relevant to modern times, including listening to science, patriotism versus nationalism,
the world's going to end,
fear, misunderstanding. Yeah, he has a pretty broad body of work that was popular at the box office, and Godzilla vs. Kong is coming out soon, and it would be a good time to get into what works and what doesn't in potentially bad kaiju flicks. So real quick, just so you know, because we know that there is kind of like this monster theme that is in the air right now, we're actually going to be doing Pacific Rim in 2 weeks' time. So we'll be talking about Pacific Rim in 2 weeks' time, but maybe that'll open us up to then maybe doing another director deep dive, and we could talk about Godzilla versus Kong and various other things. So that is going to be coming up in the future. What do y'all think about Roland Emmerich?
I love the dude, man. I think it's an art to figure out how to destroy the world in different cool ways. I'm a big fan of the genre of the world ending and stuff. I think it's fun. So I think he's a master at it. Although I definitely think that Independence Day, once again, I look at Independence Day at the effects, and there was a lot of computer CGI effects in that, but it looks great. It like really it works. And then I look at his later work. Roland Emmerich's later films in 2012 or Ice Age or whatever, or not Ice Age, whatever, the 10,000 BC. And it's like so CGI heavy to the point of cartoon ridiculousness that I'm like,
yeah.
He obviously loves that shit, but I think he goes overboard. I wish he could somehow revert to his 97 filmmaking style with ID4.
I think Independence Day is a hell of a good time. And that is another movie that just feels of its era. You know, I lament this often, that the only big action movies we get anymore, the only big sci-fi movies we get anymore are just superheroes. Like, unless, once again, Christopher Nolan kind of has a blank check to do what he wants over there at Warner Brothers, maybe not so much anymore after bagging on HBO Max the way that he did. But we never get those big budget science fiction movies anymore, and I think that's a real shame, because Independence Day was one of those that, like, you could not escape when that came out, from the Super Bowl commercial clear through to summer, when like people were going crazy for that movie. I think I went and saw that 2 or 3 times with my parents.
I mean, dude, yeah, that I will never forget watching that. I mean, I literally saw it on 4th of July weekend. Whenever that was, 96 or something.
Such a great sense of scale in that movie. And like, once again, it inspires awe.
Yeah. And it's also a well-made story and, you know, a fun crowd pleasing piece of entertainment. Right. Is what I would say. If, like, when you watched that movie, you were like, wow, that was a fucking movie. And that rarely happens these days.
Yeah, so maybe what we'll do is we'll do a patron poll where we just have like Roland Emmerich, Roland Emmerich, Roland Emmerich, Roland Emmerich, and Roland Emmerich. And maybe we just do, I don't know. Let us know.
Look, I love the guy, but there really are only a few cream of the crop of his filmography, okay? Of his disaster porn. Stargate.
Well, maybe we can do a one-off. Maybe we'll do a one-off of Emmerich at some point, not do a retrospective, but who knows. So that's right. You can email us, movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. Give us your thoughts on the films that we discuss. Send us your movie suggestions. Again, call us at 1-213-534-8807. We got to get out of here. Where can people find you on the internet, Raymond?
You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria, C-R-E-A-M-A-T-O-R-I-A.
And Ryan?
You can find me at Ryan Shorts on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and stuff, or Ryan's Game Show on Twitter, and I release comedy shorts. I'm going to release a huge one, man, with, I can't tell you anything about it.
It's going to be hook-sized.
It's going to be hook-sized. It's going to be great. you'll like it.
Neverland-sized. And yeah.
Austin, before you give your info and sign-off, we also know what we're going to do next week, don't we?
Yeah, I think we're going to be talking about the Wes Anderson film Fantastic Mr. Fox. Is that correct?
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Nice. I think we agreed on that one. So just to whet people's appetites before we go.
Yeah, so make sure you check that out so you can tune in with us next week and you can be a little bit more engaged with the chat, or you can get a refresher on it if you haven't seen it a while. In the meantime, you can hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden. You can hit me up on Insta, AUS_HAY. I'm relaunching my YouTube channel. I kind of haven't really done much with it lately, but I'm basically going to be doing like little philosophical, political commentary stuff, the stuff that is my forte as
capitalism,
a kind of
communism,
professional philosopher.
All the things that lose your butts.
By the way, Mr. Sexy Noodles, you owe me a beer. Go ahead and hit my YouTube channel up. It's 21st Century Renaissance Man, or you can just Google Austin Hayden Smith and you'll find it. But yeah, we love you. Send us out, Ryan.
Goodbye from Neverland. This has been Show Me the Meaning.